You're listening to The Naked Truth, Queer Artist Interviews. I'm Peter, your host, and together we're going to sit down and unzip with some amazing creators and learn the naked truth about their work, their lives, and what it means to make art as a queer person. Thanks for joining. This show explores the area of human sexuality and contains some adult content. Today, I'm joined by Alex Temple. She is a queer composer, writer, performer, educator, and self-described polystylist, postmodernist, and surrealist. In February of 2020, Julia Holter and Spectral Quartet performed Alex's song cycle, Behind the Wallpaper, at the Music Box Theater in Chicago, alongside the works by two fellow trans artists, composer Jean Knifick and filmmaker Lyra Hill. Alex, thank you so much for joining me today.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
There is a lot to talk about, but I want to talk about one of your self-descriptive words, which is postmodernist.
Uh-oh. Don't tell Jordan Peterson.
Well, I mean, but in some ways, that's exactly why I want to dive into it, because it is a word that has so many malleable meanings, depending on who is saying it, depending on their motivations. So can you talk about what a word like that means? And I'm sure it will be interacting with the other self-described labels of things like polystylist and surrealist.
I think of the word postmodernism as making more sense if it breaks down into postmodernism rather than postmodernism. And postmodern does have its set of meanings, which are based more on a very specific technical usage of the word modern. But I think of it more in terms of modernism, making an ism out of how modern you are, which is the idea of, in this case, music history as directional, always improving, a linear historical narrative. Todd Levin has this piece called Todd Levin, which is actually an interview with himself, including a soprano singing, "What kind of music do you write?" And he answers in speech, and it's with orchestra. And it's this whole elaborate meta commentary. And one of the things he talks about is that his teachers viewed music history as a well-manicured highway, whereas he views it more as a muddy swamp crisscrossed by paths in all directions. That, to me, is an essentially postmodernist understanding of intellectual and artistic history. Modernism in the context of classical music also connotes creating sort of a walled garden for specialist avant-garde research, and outside the wall is all forms of non-classical music. I am completely uninterested in that wall. I would like to knock it down. I mean, and it's being knocked down, and it's been knocked down. And of course, it's not like I'm the only person doing this or that this is a new phenomenon. But for me, I am much more interested in the web of interconnections between different musics than in putting them into reified categories, which are then placed into a hierarchy. So that's a short version of what I mean by postmodernism.
Thank you, because that does lead into discussions of the polystylism in several of the pieces that you've shared with us today. I do want to talk a little more about your artistic background and maybe the interactions in that which have led both to a primary interest in music, your own musical or artistic training, and maybe pushing back against some of that.
Yeah, so the funny thing is that even though I am so sort of into breaking down these icons now, my background is very establishment, to be honest. I did my undergrad at Yale. Like, I don't even talk about that most of the time because I feel so weird about having been associated with this conservative and often oppressive institution. That said, my music education there was not as limited as you might expect. For example, I took an electronic music class there where, yeah, we looked at Stockhausen and that sort of thing, but we also looked at Aphex Twin and Kraftwerk and Laurie Anderson, who of course also are all white. So, you know, this is not the full story of electronic music at all, which, did you know, by the way, that the first drum and bass album released in the US was by a black trans woman?
While I did not know that, that fact does not surprise me anymore.
Yeah, Jordana Lassane, also known as 187, great stuff. I got into electronic music before I went to college. The first electronic music I made was when I was 17. I made a frankly pretty bad album called Purple, Sparkly, and Ridiculous using Cakewalk, a DAW that I'm not sure even exists anymore, which I was introduced to by a friend who had a copy of it. And the two of us had tried to start a band, but it kind of didn't work out. We only ended up recording about a minute and a half of music. And so so our theoretical band, which was called Trying to Finish The, did not get off the ground. But I went and spent 2 months making some very messy electronic music, just experimenting with all kinds of editing and recording random objects I had around my house. And, you know, the result wasn't great, but it was definitely not bound to any kind of classical music aesthetics. The big thing for me was that I, in high school, had gotten very into psychedelic rock, mainly through my dad's record collection. He also introduced me to Frank Zappa, which was probably my first introduction to polystylism, was Zappa. And at the end of high school, two things happened. My dad got a new car, which had a better radio for some reason, and which could pick up the Boston College radio station, WZBC, which had entire hours per day dedicated to what they called no commercial potential. That was one. This was the year 2000, so the other thing was Napster.
Yes.
And between the two of those, I discovered this entire world of experimental rock bands. And in particular, while Googling the phrase no commercial potential, which, by the way, also is a Zappa coinage. Actually, no, that wouldn't have been Google yet. By Alta Vista-ing the phrase no commercial potential, I stumbled across the playlist of some other radio station and just started downloading stuff by the bands that were listed, which included Henry Cow and Art Bears and Thinking Plague. And that was my introduction to the Amon Prague world. And bands like Thinking Plague, who used rock band instrumentation, but were also heavily influenced in their harmonic and melodic and rhythmic language by composers like Bartok and Stravinsky. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, these two things that I love, they don't have to be separate. And that was a big revelation for me. And that led me to a prog rock news group where I got more recommendations than I could know what to do with. Bands like U-Totem and Koenji Hyake and Eschaton and Magma and Universe Zero. And for a while, that was kind of my aesthetic center point for a couple of years, in right before and then at the beginning of college. And so by the time I was a sophomore in undergrad, I was kind of anti-establishment in a very 19-year-old way, and like writing manifestos about how, you know, the self-publishing independent underground would be dancing on the graves of the snobs of the old order and stuff like that. And I made another album of electronic music, which was actually not bad. And I started my own quote-unquote label out of my bedroom, which meant that I burned CDs and sent them to my friends and some reviewers.
Right.
And, you know, that didn't really go anywhere, but that was my main aesthetic focus. I wasn't listening to anything from before the 20th century. A lot of experimental rock stuff and Berio and Penderecki and stuff like that. And it was only later that year that I took a music history class that kind of reinvigorated my love for 19th century music. And I was like, oh, wait a minute, actually, I also care about this stuff. I didn't start getting into mainstream pop music until the end of college. I was a big snob back then. Not a classical music snob, but an indie music snob. And it was my senior year of college when a friend introduced me to Outkast, and I was like, oh, current mainstream music is good, actually. And that really was what helped me kind of break down the last barrier, which was things that are popular, which I had had a lot of suspicion of, I think partially due to just like having been bullied a lot in elementary school, to be honest. Like, oh, popular kids. Anything they listen to must be suspect. No, that's not how it works.
It feels like then I probably went about it the wrong way in asking more about your education, because it sounds like what we think of as training was like a jello that you passed through, suspended in your own tastes that were formed, and an attitude towards irreverence and humor that completely existed outside of these structures.
Yeah, I think so. And I was certainly very influenced by the formal training as well.
Well, do you feel we could maybe talk about any of this through the lens of The Man Who Hated Everything?
Ha! Yeah, absolutely.
There's a bunch of things we've already talked about. I mean, it is a irreverent tribute to Zappa, which is the only way to respectfully tribute Zappa.
Oh yeah, you gotta make fun of him, because A, he would do it himself, and B, he absolutely deserved it. So trying to get it to cohere, that was something that I struggled with a lot while writing that piece. And what I eventually landed on, which is a technique I've used in other pieces, just maybe not quite so extensively, is bringing back melodies in different stylistic guises. And so typically it's not the exact same rhythms or intervals, but it's approximately the same. And so that piece begins with, you know, this melody very much in a Zappa-esque style. Bum, ba, 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 and so on. And it comes back as a kind of Thelonious Monk meets Mission piano solo at one point. It comes back as this very slowed down melody played by piccolo and high violins with harmonics ad lib over semi-aleatoric texture. That's one of the anchors of the piece, is that that contour and approximate rhythm come back in a number of different guises. And then other things are sandwiched in between. But it's not the only melody that does that. Also in the opening section, there's this tune that's like, ba 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 ba, ba 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 da 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 da. I'm not singing that very well, but that's the general contour of it. That comes back as this kind of atonal chamber music thing. It comes back, bits of it, in a kind of pseudo bossa nova context at one point.
Oh, I love that one.
Yeah. So that's one of the animating principles. There's about maybe four melodies that come back in different guises over and over again. The other thing has to do with pacing. And so up until the moment that that sort of 60s advertising film strip with a bossa nova tinge slash British light music thing comes in, which is about two-thirds of the way into the piece, up until that point, there are frequent stops and starts and a lot of tempo changes and a lot of pauses. But from that point on to the end, it's a straight line through with one significant pause right before the voices come in. And so at that point, once I've established a groove, it's actually two grooves. There's kind of the bossa-esque groove, and then there's the Grease Summer Nights groove, which takes over. And at that point, a whole bunch of the melodies from earlier come back, sometimes in fragments, into this kind of stylistic stew, where it's not really styles at that point that Zappa was interested in. It's more things that I associate with California and with LA. So there's definitely a Jobim influence in there. I love Jobim. I've listened to him plenty. But there's also, I don't even know, stuff that sounds kind of like the Archies, Sugar Sugar, you know, kind of like 60s feel-good music mixed in there as well. And then I take this very like crunchy atonal prog rock melody from earlier, and I just drop it almost note for note, transposed but all the same intervals and rhythms, into a tonal context and label it like Really Unfortunate Christmas Music in the score, because it's all, you know, shimmery vibraphones and stuff like that. So it's a bunch of stuff from earlier getting recontextualized, but now they start being fragmented and layered on top of each other. So in that sense, I mean, maybe you could look at that as a kind of development section. And that's the thing. I feel like, you know, the formal principles that I use owe a lot to 19th century classical music. It's just that the way that they manifest in terms of meaning and culture and timbre and harmonic language are totally different. It's not talking about classical music. The piece is talking about Frank Zappa and California culture and the sort of cultural iconicity of California.
Can you elaborate a little more on California culture for those of us in other parts of the country who've only had very sporadic visits?
Yeah. So first of all, Zappa, a lot of his material, especially early on, is about LA and the surrounding area, lyrically, and to some extent also about San Francisco. For example, on the early Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention album, We're Only in It for the Money, a lot of that is about making fun of the hippie culture, which he saw as a cheapening and commercialization of true counterculture. And so there's a lot of making fun of San Francisco there. But there are just casual references to places around LA all over the Mothers of Invention albums. And I wrote that piece for Wild Up, which is an LA-based group, which was part of the reason that I decided to do a Zappa tribute in the first place. I put together the pieces of LA plus Chris Roundtree when I asked him, describing the ensemble as janky and noisy, plus having an ensemble to write for whose players came from a variety of different backgrounds, both classical and popular and experimental, and some of whom were improvisers. And that all added up to, maybe I should do a Zappa tribute. And so when I was deciding what kinds of materials to include in terms of stylistic reference points, some of them were things that Zappa himself was interested in. So 20th century classical music, doo-wop, free jazz, and so on. And then others were things that I associate with, not so much with my actual time in California, and I've spent a fair amount of time there, but with representations of California harkening back to the 1960s, which is why there's this kind of vaguely bossa-derived advertising film strip music kind of section. And there's also some very proggy prog rock in there that's just, I don't know, I don't even have a conscious reason why I associated that with SoCal, but I did. another big polystylistic influence on me early on was the band Mr. Bungle and their album California, which is a brilliant, if sometimes problematic, slab of polystylism. And a lot of the stuff that they're referencing in there is doo-wop, surf rock. There's a lot of shiny major seventh chords and the sounds of seagulls and that sort of thing. And so that's just kind of something I've absorbed into my music in a general sense. And those things are certainly present in The Man Who Hated Everything as well.
I'm very glad that you used the phrase that you've absorbed this into your music, because I wanted to ask a question about another sort of broad concept that I'd say either comes from or is within the music history as a linear progression kind of mode of thinking, which is the idea of the artistic voice. Out of the things that you've presented for this podcast for examples of your work, two of them are, I would say, sort of collage-based. One is a literal collage, the other is a stylistic pastiche. And as you describe yourself as a polystylist, what weight do you put on a word like voice when it comes to describing an artist? Is that a term or concept that's even relevant for you? And how do you feel that interacts with your creative process?
It's not a thing I think about very much. I think that to a degree, there is such a thing as an artistic voice, but I think the concept needs to be problematized.
Okay.
A lot of people equate artistic voice with specific style characteristics, like rhythmic language or harmonic language. I think that's simplistic and dangerous, potentially, because it encourages composers to kind of limit themselves artificially. I think sometimes about Steve Reich and how he's been kind of just doing the same thing since the 70s.
Yeah.
And I wonder, does he get tired of it? Does he ever think, I wish I could write something that's non-repetitive and that uses crunchy, super dissonant harmonies and has singers singing with lots of vibrato and no vibraphones or marimbas in sight. But whoever commissioned me doesn't want that because they want a Steve Reich piece trademark. I have no idea. Maybe not. Probably not all the stuff I said. That would be very surprising. But I see this a lot with composers who kind of become famous doing a thing and then they just keep doing the thing. So I think that there's a degree to which artistic voice is something that happens unconsciously. So like you look at a composer like Louis Andriessen, who is best known for these big monumental minimalist things that he did in the 70s and 80s. But that's not all he's written. He also can write very mellifluous melodies if you look at a piece like Writing to Vermeer. And he can do little character piano pieces and spare abstract string quartet music and all of this different kind of stuff. But it all feels like it comes out of his particular personality and set of interests. I think personality is a concept that's more how I think about these things than voice. Because the word voice has been kind of skunked by this just endless terrible discourse. I think that people need to discover what their own taste is and that people think that they just kind of automatically know it. You don't automatically know it because everybody's got their brain full of all sorts of ingrained biases, just like I was, you know, snobby in all these ways and excluding things out of sheer ignorance. When I was 14, that was excluding everything outside of classical music. When I was 19, that was excluding mainstream pop music. And I didn't even realize how ignorant I was of music from the rest of the world until even after that. I think this also applies not just to listening, but to making music. If you are a person who makes music, you need to take time to discover what it is that you actually want to do and shake off the notions that you may have about what you're supposed to do. And a lot of people have these ingrained notions of various sorts, both conscious and unconscious. I remember a friend of mine years ago talking about a piece he was working on. He said, I really want to do this, but I feel like it's too obvious. And I was like, what does too obvious mean? Why is that a bad thing? That's an ingrained notion that exists in the contemporary classical music world that may align perfectly with some people's tastes who really like subtle gestures, but it shouldn't be a default for everybody. Likewise, I had a student some years ago who was writing kind of power pop kind of stuff. And I remember initially, everything he was writing fit into groups of four-bar phrases. And I pointed this out. It wasn't something that he consciously thought I should write four-bar phrases. It was just a default. And we looked at some music, you know, pop and rock songs that did otherwise. And it loosened up his rhythmic and phrasal language quite a bit. And that doesn't mean he never wrote another four-bar phrase, but he had more options and discovered, again, what it was that he really wanted to do. So when I think about the whole question of artistic voice, I think what it comes down to is discovering what it is you want to hear and discovering what it is you want to write, as opposed to what you have been told explicitly or implicitly by instruction or by omission that you should be listening to and writing or playing.
I'm going to take that wonderfully concise description and transpose it to the key of queer, because what you just said feels itself like a wonderful encapsulation of the trajectory of self-discovery and queer identity.
Abso-fucking-lutely.
So can you take us either from the ground up or from wherever you'd want to in talking about your journey as a queer person?
That's a long story. Okay, let's see. Queerness for me followed on transness. That is to say, before I started transitioning, I didn't think of myself as queer. I had a lot of queer friends, but I was like always, you know, the kid with the straight but not narrow pin on my backpack, you know, when I was in my late teens, and the like, you know, went to pride marches to support my friends and so on. And I did enjoy playing around with gender. I knew that. I identified as a crossdresser for a long time, and I would take opportunities like going to Rocky Horror or costume parties to do that. By the time I was in college, I sort of had a sense that something was up with gender, but I didn't know what to do with it. And that's partially because the kind of landscape of possibilities for queer identity that are available now were just not to the same degree then. They were around. I did know somebody who self-described as genderqueer, but for the most part, the prominent image, and we're talking like first half of the 2000s, that was available online, was that being trans meant that you believe that men have these personality traits and women have those personality traits, and then you medically transition in all these ways, and then you try to blend it. And I had no idea that this was something being imposed on trans people by the medical establishment at that age. I just saw that and thought, but things are more complicated than that. So I didn't know how to connect to it. But at the same time, I wrote these long introspective life journal entries about like, what is gender anyway? This doesn't make sense. Why do I feel like this when I wear this and what's going on? I think I might've started to transition at the end of college if I hadn't had the great misfortune of stumbling by accident in an effort to learn more about feminism into a lot of kind of turf light, second wavy rad femme stuff, which gave me a terrible guilt complex and delayed the whole thing by about 5 years. But 5 years later, after finding that my wanting to play with gender presentation felt more and more of like a necessity, and then starting to date somebody who did not have a like cis normative view of me and who was perfectly happy to call me by different pronouns and a different name, I started identifying as genderqueer. So that was in my mid-20s. I'm still using the word identify. I was genderqueer. It wasn't temporary. I mean, it was temporary, but it wasn't any less real. Mm-hmm. It was just where I was at the time. So I was genderqueer. You know, in retrospect, I tend to say non-binary, but I didn't really use that word at the time. I used the word genderqueer for 3 or 4 years. And for a while, I was using different names and pronouns in different contexts. And I sort of gradually came around to describing myself as trans. And being queer just kind of almost by accident followed on from that, because I continued to be attracted to women while shifting to first a genderqueer and then a female identity. And also, as I got to know more and more non-binary people, I found I'm often attracted to them as well. And a lot of my former partners, in fact, ended up coming out as non-binary later on. And at some point, I discovered that I'm occasionally attracted to men, but less frequently. Yeah, so queerness was kind of a tag-along to transness. And at a certain point, I found myself shifting more towards more of a trans woman self-conception. And really the moment of truth was when I went to the Fresh Ink Festival, which was 9 years ago now. And I thought, oh, I am going to be around a bunch of people who don't already have a preconception of me. What if I just presented as a girl all the time? Which I did. And I was like, hey, this feels amazing. This is way better. So at that point, I would say that I shifted my self-conception towards being a quote-unquote binary trans woman, even though I still don't like believe in binaries, you know what I mean?
Right.
But yeah, for want of a better term, a binary trans woman. And I had already at that point started laser hair removal on my face and legally changed my name, just chopped the ander off the end, which literally cut the Greek word for man off the end of it, which I guess makes me the castrating feminist that your mother warned you about.
That's a composer bio line right there.
I know, right? I've said that before. That wasn't a spontaneous joke, but I enjoy saying it. So yeah, I was already kind of heading in that direction. That would have been, 2011 to 2012. I think it was kind of the bulk of my early transition. And the rest is history, I guess.
I would like to make some kind of connection between your artistic sensibilities, irreverence and questioning of things, and the skepticism of quote-unquote normalcy, but I'm going to pose that as a question or as a springboard rather than as a affirmative statement.
Yeah, no, I definitely think there's a connection. I actually, for a while, described my own music as genre queer, which I think you could still say. It just feels a little bit less relevant since I don't currently identify as genderqueer. But, you know, I move through the world as a woman. Doesn't mean that my conception of gender is totally straightforward or simple. I'm very aware of it being a social construct. I was also just thinking about how, like, Yakko Warner is totally part of my gender from Animaniacs, you know, and has been for a long time. So, you know, whatever you want to do with that, you can do with that. But I think there are common elements of my own sort of tendencies or personality that have made it easier for me to end up in the places I ended up. One of which is just a general distrust of authority, which has been true since I was a tiny kid. My reaction to being told what to do was always why. And of course, lots of kids are like that, but a lot of them don't stay like that. And a lot of our, you know, the mainstream discourse kind of assumes that you're not supposed to stay like that. And when people say you're not supposed to stay like that, I want to be like, okay, but why? Because I'm very distrustful of the way that people are told to and trained to conform. And it's hard to talk about this without sounding like, you know, a teenage Nine Inch Nails fan, but it's really dangerous, you know? That imposed conformity subjects people to the violence of white supremacist, capitalist, cis-hetero patriarchy. So I think these are really important issues. And I'm sure, obviously, you agree, and probably anybody listening to a queer podcast already agrees with that as well, so I don't really need to defend it.
Doesn't hurt.
But I think that has also correlated with, yeah, it doesn't hurt, that's true, with a skepticism of fixed categories. And a lot of people feel that way, and they respond to it in different ways. It doesn't have to lead to polystylism, but in my case, I don't want to throw out the categories. I want to play with them. And historically, I've played a lot with gender categories in my own personal sort of self-expression. That's not true anymore. But like, I have described my gender as 80s and as skeptical raised eyebrow and like all kinds of random shit at various points in my life because I didn't have a better answer. And now, yeah, okay, so I can say I'm a woman, I'm a trans woman. Fine, that's what it is. But I still look at gender as a whole, and it's like a, well, going back to Todd Levin, it's a muddy swamp crisscrossed by paths going in various directions, not a well-manicured highway.
Right. Why should we trust taxonomy over the instability of experience?
The instability of experience. Yes, thank you. Exactly. The beautiful chaos of experience. This is me with linguistics, too. People try to impose order on language. Language has never been orderly. And actually, this intersects with certain tropes in queer activism that bother me too, which is, so, you know, you'll see the argument that the reason the word transgendered is dispreferred is that the past participle form implies that it's something that happened to you. That's not the problem. The problem is that transgendered has been used by ignorant people too much and that skunked the word. The grammatical argument doesn't make any sense. If you say that a zebra is striped, that doesn't mean somebody came and printed stripes on it.
Right.
You know, that's just not how language works. People make these specious arguments when they should be talking about social factors. What makes words derogatory or dispreferred or even slurs is social factors. It's how people use them in the context of social hierarchies and in the context of forms of power over and domination and oppression, the not fun kind of domination. It's not, you know, that the syntax is wrong.
Right. Well, to wrap us up, reflect a little bit on COVID. The question is getting weirder because I used to ask about what people sort of wanted post-COVID to look like and what they were looking forward to in that. And it's ever more complicated by the fact that while vaccination is accelerated in the United States, globally, it's a complete atrocity. So I'm just inviting you to reflect on something about COVID, maybe with a glance towards the future.
Jeez. COVID has really ripped the mask, so to speak, off of a lot of very grim things about the world, including, yes, global inequity with regard to healthcare, including the immensely destructive results of an ideology based on individual liberty rather than collective liberation. Oh, I don't even know where to go with this. I will say on a more personal note that I've been very isolated. I live alone. During the entire time that I was in isolation, I'm now vaccinated, so I'm gradually starting to emerge. But during that entire time, I had one partner from San Diego who came and visited some number of times, and sometimes with their partner who they also live with, who I'm kind of involved with as well in a sort of nebulous way. But other than that, I basically didn't see anybody. It was really bad for me. And I think a lot of us are having trouble coming out of that due to trauma. I think I said the other day, I feel like I've become slightly agoraphobic. I know a lot of people that feel that way. I was supposed to go to a small gathering of people yesterday, which would have been the first time I'd seen local friends in person since before this started. And I couldn't go. I couldn't, my brain just decided, you know, that the idea of being perceived by people was too daunting. So I'm working on it. But yes, it's also true that this is just all in the context of the US, where we've got the vaccines in ways that they're just not available in other places. And that's really deeply horrifying. I guess none of this adds up to a particularly cohesive statement. It's just a big, awful mess.
Well, that is itself a cohesive statement, maybe.
Yeah.
Anyway, just so one last thing to push us back towards a conclusion with the big, horrible mess that everything is. Is there anything you can speak about in that future optimistically? Maybe even just a collaboration you're getting off the ground?
Yeah.
Or, you know, the next chance for something in person that you feel will happen in a time frame that you'll have been adjusted to?
Yeah, well, I don't know exactly when I will next, you know, have a piece performed in person that I will attend. I have had a couple of pieces already performed in person since COVID. What I'm looking forward to more than anything is that now that the semester is wrapping up, I feel like, so the semester is wrapping up, Trump is gone, and I personally am not paralyzed by fear about getting COVID anymore. So I will actually this summer have time to write music and like actually give it my full attention. Not to say that I'm going to become politically disengaged, because I don't think I'm even capable of that, but to carve out time to actually think about the music I'm writing. I've got so many projects that are sort of stalled in being partially finished, and I'm eager to get to them. And I really feel like my output has considerably slowed down since Trump was elected, because just my entire consciousness has had this running stream of doom. And I still feel kind of doomy, but I don't know, not quite to the same degree.
It's a low bar to cross, but I agree. Thank you so much for joining me, and I really look forward to hearing some of those stalled projects reach fruition and delivered in whatever format or future that might be, because one of the things that is at least exciting to me about post-COVID, in the enormous air quotes we've just talked about, you know, post-COVID musical performance having a component of greater geographic accessibility, so that it's not just about the concert in person, but there's a way to interact with something with an artist whose work you're interested in and enthusiastic about from across the country or across the world. Thank you so much for coming on, Alex. I'm very glad to hear that you are fully vaccinated. So while I end almost every episode by saying, stay safe, I know that that is a little easier.
Thank you.
Thanks for spending some time with us on The Naked Truth. If you want to learn more about this episode's artist, be sure to look through the links in the podcast description. Please consider how you can support the creative people on this show and in your community. Art helps us all get through, and that's the naked truth.